May the words of my mouth and thoughts of my heart be acceptable before you, Hashem, my rock and my redeemer. Shalom Aleichem. Welcome everybody. This is our series in the Gateway to Kabbalah. We are in lesson 3 of this series. We're broadcasting the series live in our Monday night open forums. It is today, Monday, the 11th of June in the year 2012. And before we went live here in this recording, those of you here know, I was playing for you a selection of songs. Now, as you know, this Gateway of Kabbalah series is talking about what we call the Ten Sefirot, the divine attributes or manifestations of God in creation. I have been trying since the beginning to divest you of any concepts of mythology, fantasy, that have become so entrenched and ingrained in our religious thoughts. When we discuss theology, for lack of a better word, there are numerous books written by numerous authors, each one with their own viewpoint, ideas, opinions, etc. This body of mystical literature has become known as the Kabbalah Iyunit, or we call the theoretical or the philosophical Kabbalah. The topic of the Sefirot, is well spoken of in all of that genre of material. However, the Sefirot is made very clear in the first book that mentions them, clearly at least as early as the 3rd century of the Common Era, and I refer to the Sefer Yetzirah. They are referred to as having no such essence or ability of description as that attributed to the later authors. And it's a point that I've made in earlier classes. The difference between earlier and later is really the difference between experience and non-experience. Somebody can go to school and learn everything that the books have to teach them and graduate with a big fancy degree and yet know nothing about the practical applications of that which they have learned. Nowhere is this more so than with these concepts, these energies, these fields called Sefirot. Though the later Kabbalah enumerates them in great detail, I assure you, Sefirot are not things to be thought about. They are experiences which underlie the fabric and structure of nature itself. They are, if you will, the laws of nature. In our previous two classes, we discussed what is referred to as the upper triad, the Sefirot, which we've given names Keter, Chochmah, Bina, and we referred to them as the domain, the realms of mind. Well, God, who we call God, is actually the universal mind. Matter of fact, just to date myself now, I'm going to give you a little preview, an essay that I'm going to be posting later this week on the topic of prayer. And I'm going to be writing a number of essays about prayer, simply because I don't think today people understand what prayer is all about. You read words from a book and you think that you're praying. Well, according to the letter of the law, I guess you are. And then you wonder why those prayers are not answered. Simply because that's not what really prayer is all about. And in order for us to understand what prayer is, we have to understand to whom or what we are praying. And a point we must understand, God is not an anthropomorphized superhuman being. That comes out of Greco-Roman pagan beliefs. God's not a human being. We symbolically refer to God as a king, as a father, or as a lord. But I cannot emphasize enough that these things are only symbols, similes, metaphors, with no actual reality to them. So real is this, to burst some bubbles here, when the soul leaves the body and goes off into other dimensions, we believe that we go off to this big palace in the sky, wherever that is, and we approach this big super tall throne, and there's this big being of light there that says, "Hi, I'm God." Well, according to anybody who's ever ascended, that ain't true. Because even the angels ask, "Where is God's place?" There is no God to be seen. Now, in certain meditative traditions, specifically the Abulafia school, we're taught to try to personify some essence of image in our mind and project upon that God. But that's only a mental construct, like a crutch, to help the mind think. You must go beyond your crutch to learn to walk tall and firm before you can run and then fly. With regards to this type of understanding, you must know that without experience, you will never know. God, what we call God, even the referred to God as a he, as is done in Scripture, is symbolic and metaphorical. God is not a he, not a she. If anything, you can refer to God as it. God is the universal mind, the consciousness, the thought of existence. Everything exists for a reason. Whether we're talking about superstrings or quarks or neutrons and electrons, something inherent within each and every one of these things and everything that's built from them is what it is. A proton is not an electron. Electron is not a proton. They just are what they are. Why? Gee, I don't know. I've really never had a personal conversation with a proton, or an electron for that matter. But something inherent within them defines, I am this and not that. I operate like this and not like that. My parameters are this and not that. We might refer to that information as being the laws of nature. In religion, we refer to that as the mind of God. They are one and the same. I'm trying to extract the concept of God from mythology into the reality. To take it out of this concept of a personality and to let you recognize the grandiosity. The universal mind is in everything, everywhere, in every way. Before we began this class, as I mentioned, I was playing to you some musical tunes. Now, from my personal background, I have those songs which move me. And everyone, of course, has their own different songs. We all, if you will, march to the beat of a different drummer. The point in music is that it unleashes the intellect from its sheath and allows a person to feel. And feelings, not emotions, are very important. Now, we just said that God is the universal mind. Well, one of my favorite verses, as we know, Proverbs 19:21. Many are the thoughts in the hearts of men, but it's the counsel of Hashem that shall arise. Now, We all think many thoughts. At any one moment, our minds are racing out of control with many thoughts. Question. Ask yourself this, please. Which thoughts do you choose to act upon and implement and transform from a mere thought into action? What motivates you to do this, but not that? So, for example, if you think about, now again, I'm going to speak within my personal context. One of the foods I have to admit I always enjoy the best is good old-fashioned New York pizza. Those of you who are New Yorkers, you know you can't beat a New York pizza. Not in Chicago, not anywhere else. New York pizza is the best. I go to New York, first thing I do is I get pizza. So if I'm sitting there and I'm saying pizza, 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 the desire for it arouses me to translate the thought into a deed. Do you understand? You can translate any thought into any deed, but what it requires is passion, feeling. Even the universal mind operates as we do. We are created in the image of the universal mind. Therefore, the transformation from thought into deed goes through what we can call the heart, feelings. I don't like to use the word emotions because of their humanity. Feelings are a very deep part of ourselves. And when I use the word feelings, I'm talking about the deep inner conviction, knowing, and the like. It's something that I wrote a long time ago. The basic Kabbalistic concepts and terminologies. It's an ebook. It's available on koshertorah.com. I summarized the 10 sefirot in this manner. In the beginning of thought, there is will. Will reveals itself through enlightenment. Enlightenment is understood through intelligence. Intelligence is aroused through passion. Passion gives rise to action. In the beginning, there is will. In the end, there is action. Last in action, first in thought. The beginning is in the end. The end is in the beginning. This is the secret of Torah and the way of heaven. As we continue now in our discussion of the sefirot, I'm going to introduce to you now the three sefirot called Chesed, Gevura, and Tiferet. As we're going to see, these are referenced to being the body, as opposed to the upper three sefirot being the mind. These forces, if you will, are universal. Oh gosh, sometimes words escape even me. Universal forces. I don't know how better to describe them. They're just powers, energies, which motivate, direct. Maybe we can call them positive and negative. Maybe we can call them universal constants. Somebody's mentioning that here. But a constant indicates non-movement. These forces are always in movement. Before I read to you from within the text, which is going to be the classic definition, let me try the best I can make you understand the best I can. has said in the four opposing forces. Yeah, that's true, but what does that mean? That's what we must understand. There is a force in the universe which by nature is constructive and expansive. It's always going outward, moving. It reminds me of something that I read about in science literature today, that they say our universe is expanding. Well, if it is, and there is a force which is expanding it, that is the force which we can call chesed. Forget about applying it humanly. Forget about applying it to just human emotions. It is an expressive, outgoing force of expansion. I don't even want to use the term building per se, because it even transcends building. A point that's made in the philosophical Kabbalah of the Ari, which is very appropriate here, is that these forces, which we're going to call Chesed and Gevura, up until Tiferet, he says that these are concealed forces. Orot mechusim. The word concealed, let us properly interpret as being unconscious. The force of Gevura is juxtaposed in opposition to the expansiveness of what we called chesed. The original word is gedola, which means greatness. It's an expansive property. Gevura is a constrictive property. The two of them relate to one another like breathing. In, out. There is this constant ebb and flow. This is the underlying movement in everything. It's what underlies a bell curve, in what underlies the spiral and the Fibonacci sequence. There is always movement to one side and then another, back and forth. It is not idolatrous to refer to it almost as a yin-yang, because the yin-yang is a philosophical construct which I personally believe is based on Torah principles. There's always this constant movement. It's always referred to, as we're going to see here in the text, day, night. There is always this constant movement, what we see in existence between positive and negative polarities. Did you ever stop to think? We know of positive and negative polarities with grounding in the center. Is it possible that there are other polarities out there that we don't even know of? Don't be so quick to say yes or no. Because of what we don't know, what can we say? Now, Chesed and Gevura, expanding, contracting. This is why I didn't want to use the word building with regards to Chesed. Why? Because then you would think that Gevura is destruction. Well, it kind of is. But this is one of those mystical concepts referred to in the Talmud. For those of you who have not read my recent essay on the misunderstood mystical Talmud, it is on koshertorah.com right now today and will be continued up there in the popular essays section. Because most people don't realize that the sages of the Talmud, they knew what we're talking about right now. They weren't these Greek-oriented, rationally intellectual types. They were all practitioners of the old Merkava and Hechalot schools. They knew these things through experience. And therefore, when they introduce a legal concept, listur almanat lifnot, which means to break down for the sake of building up, that is gevura. That's why I don't want to refer to Chesed as building and Gevura as destroying, because each one complements the other. And in the philosophical Kabbalah, they speak of each sephirah having 10 sephirot within, and therefore they're each having powers and elements on the other, and our book is going to reference that in just a minute here. Part of our meditative experiential path is to become aware of these forces as they flow around us constantly. Like it says in Ecclesiastes Kohelet, there's a time and a purpose for all things under heaven. That is the revelation of the nature and the flow of the universal mind. As it is motivated by these unconscious to us forces to make happen what is meant to happen. So through our meditative practices, we endeavor to transcend the limitations of space and time and construct, and to go back into a realm where we touch the unconscious, where we don't necessarily have to be so cognizant, but we can feel. That's why I don't like the word think. We can feel this within you. And if I ask you, well, what are you feeling? You can't really put your finger on it. You're not meant to, because it's not within the domain of mind and thought. But you can feel that this is the time to go forward, or a time to stop. You can feel this is the time to build or to buy, or the time to tighten the belt. This is the time to stand up tall. This is the time to duck. Like it says, there's a time and a purpose for all things under heaven. You cannot understand that philosophically. You can only experience it with the flow of life. Let's read now in our text and understand how this is classically described. The fourth sefirot is called Chesed. Behu zarua yamin. It is the right arm. Nehalak lekama gavne ora. And it is subdivided into many different hues or shades of light. Amar David HaMelech Alav HaShalom. And with regards to this, did King David reference? Of course, I don't think this was in King David's mind, but this is how we understand the scripture verses. Quotes here, 1 Chronicles 29, verse 11. To you, Hashem, are the greatness and the might and the glory, the victory and the majesty, for all that is in the heavens and the earth is yours. Or, in the original, Lecha Hashem HaGidulah, that's Chesed, HaGivura, the second Sephira, Tiferet, Netzach, Behod. You see, the names of the Sephirot came from this verse, because those who contemplated these things needed some type of names to refer these to. So therefore, they used the words of King David. Now, did King David have these thoughts in mind that the later people did? Maybe, maybe not. At the level of the collective consciousness, who knows who came first and who didn't? You see, this is a point also we must understand. Historically speaking, King David did not think about 10 Sephirot, and he did not name them or anything of the kind. The concept and construct clearly came later in time. Period. Done deal. No one can argue that. So, along comes the later experiential mystic and says, King David meant these things in that verse. Now, a rationalist would say, well, of course he didn't. But we're not rationalists, because we recognize the limitations of what we call rationalism. The experiential sage who lived 2,000 years maybe after King David looked into the words of David and saw that which he saw. King David might not have seen that same thing consciously, but that doesn't mean it wasn't in King David's unconscious at the time. And it could be that the mind of the sage 2,000 years later, looking for some way, tapped his thoughts into the collective unconscious, which is not limited by space or time, touched the mind of a fellow soul, that of David. And David said, I'll pen some words that you can use. And then David penned those words 2,000 years in the past from that sage. And thus the two were connected, separated from space, in time, but not in mind. So don't be so quick to think and say, well, the guy in the past didn't really mean what this guy in the future said. Now, from a rationalist, superficial point of view, that might be true. But we don't know what goes on beneath the surfaces. So that which you and I will think of tomorrow might influence someone somewhere who lived 2,000 years ago. And therefore they will act then based upon what we do tomorrow. Don't think that doesn't happen. It happens all the time. There is no linear movement. Period. That's why when we say don't ever underestimate the power of your own thoughts, your own actions. Don't think that what you do tomorrow can't affect what you do or did yesterday. It might sound like a paradox, but that's only from the point of the limited mind, which doesn't see the greater reality. Somebody is asking, is it appropriate to pray for something to happen in the past? Well, from a rationalist point of view, they would say, well, you can't. But I'm not so sure that that's true. Now, can we undo the past? I believe that we can. But the point is, we would never know it. Because this is that whole thing about timelines, parallel universes and worlds, that we don't need modern science to talk about. We've known that in mystical circles, you know, forever. So, we can maybe go back into the past and change something. But our present would not change. We would just create an alternate timeline. One in which we would never know. Now, all kinds of strange and bizarre things happen of which we never ever know. We've all heard the funny, or not so funny, time paradoxes, where in which you say, what happens if you went into the past and killed your own father? Or for that matter, killed yourself as a kid? Well, you wouldn't just cease to exist. You would exist, but you would exist in a completely different parallel timeline. When Joshua held the sun in the sky for 24 hours, sages said, well, gee, that's a pretty big miracle. We know that the earth didn't stop. We know that life went on as usual everywhere else in the world except in the bubble of that one specific place which existed outside of space and time. Apparently, these are the laws of the reality. And that's what we must understand. We are part of a collective whole. We call it the collective, Jung calls it the collective unconscious. But he calls it also the absolute, the objective mind. This is where we touch God. These forces, what we talk about calling them Sephirot, are these forces which come forth. This is how we know them. This is how we experience them. This is what motivates us. So therefore, what inspires Abraham to go forth from Ur Kasdim that we read about that happened 4,000 years ago? Maybe he will be inspired by something that will happen 1,000 years in our future. Time and space, cause and effect. You think everything is so directly related? I'm sure everything is, but I'm not so sure it is as simple and direct as we think it is. So, with regards to this chesed, it says that it has many different hues, many different shades of color. Or in other words, there are many different gradients, variants of this expansive movement. It's not an homogeneous whole. It's not just one color. It's every sheet in the book of a type. which means you have many different grades, many different levels, or as the later Kabbalah would say, Sephirot within Sephirot. What is what and which is which? Well, to try to write a book about it and to try to analyze it and then put your thumb on it is, needless to say, fruitless endeavor. It is not what needs to be done. But what you need to do is to feel, to experience. And I try to get you to do just this all the time. Ki chesed kro'a gedola. It says, it is called greatness, that expansive power. He says that this is the attribute that Abraham, Father Abraham, attached himself to, and it strengthened him. Now, as we see that Isaac was attached to Gevura, and Jacob to Tiferet. These are not just symbolisms. These are natures, attributes of personality. Abraham was by definition an expansive-minded person. If you will allow me to use a modern term of Christian application, he was the first evangelist. No, of course, his good news was the message of God and Torah, but that's what he was the guy who went out in the soapbox, he's the guy who set up the tents, he was the one who preached. He was the one trying to create the movement. Abraham was an overwhelmingly wealthy man. Again, the power of expansion, moving outwards. Everything about Abraham was about getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. That's why God chose him to be his man. Abraham was so big that not only does he give birth to Israel, he gives birth to both Christendom, Islam, the right and the left hands we call symbolically Ishmael and Esau or Edom. Abraham is the daddy of them all because his expansive ability just goes on and on and on. It's the nature of a personality. That is what we're talking about. Call it maybe the positive? I don't know. Is necessarily the positive polarity that which is pushing things out? Maybe that's the negative polarity. I don't know how we can apply the real scientific. Because we say that likes attract, what is it, likes, no, opposites attract and likes repel. So the power of repelling is the expressing out. You would think, well, that's the Gevura. No, that's the Chesed. It's the pushing out. It's the moving out. That which attracts and draws in, that's Gevura. Now, continuing. Abraham embraced this. And it also says, with reference to a pasuk, it says that it is considered to be white, like snow, or like wool, or like water. And again, it quotes the verse from the book of Daniel, right, where it refers to Daniel seeing the image of the Ancient of Days, his raiment as white as snow, and the hair of his head like clean wool. His throne was sparks of fire, and its wheels were like burning fire. What does all that mean? Needless to say, this is all Daniel's vision of things. And who is this Ancient of Days that Daniel saw? Don't be so quick to say I was an image of God. Well, I was the image in Daniel's mind. That's true. But God has many different faces. A point that our sages make, that Daniel saw God dressed in white. Whereas Moses saw God at the parting of the Red Sea, you know, with a hair of head which was black. And they make all these different references to the long face and the short face, which you call Arichanpin and Ze'eranpin. This is the Zoharic philosophical Kabbalah. And then we speak of the long and short faces of each of the individual levels of the worlds. And on it goes down into details. none of which matter if you can't experience and understand it within. Because talk is cheap. So, again, our text continues and gives the example of the gradient levels he's here. He says, "Kamo sheha marfek gadol mina zarua vesrua mina yad vehayad mina etzba veetzba gadol mechavero." Just like the elbow is greater than the lower arm, the lower arm bigger than the hand, hand bigger than the finger, and the thumb bigger than the other fingers. "Kamo sheha marfek dabuk etzel aguf yoter mina zarua." Just like the elbow, closer to the body. Thus, we find that the chassidim, you have greater ones and bigger ones. And he says here in conclusion, "Veha mevin yavin." No one who understands. This is not words that you can apply intellectually, philosophically. The power of this expansiveness has gradient levels. Like it says, there's a time and a purpose for all things under heaven. No, I can't define for you what those gradients are. You want a metaphorical, symbolic term to refer to it as? Fine. We can refer to the 10 sefirot within the sefirot chesed. Or, if you will, the 10 sefirot within the right hand of Ze'er Anpin, Zah. And then we can go into all the details. The people talk, but they don't feel. And therefore they continue talking, because once someone feels and knows, there's nothing more to say, because you know. This concludes the description that our book has for Chesed. And it concludes on the words, "The ones who understand will understand." Because that which translates mind is an outward expansive movement. Indeed, when God first created the universe, the Midrash teaches us, it went out and out and out until he finally said, "Enough." The original force of what we call the Big Bang was this expansive form of the Chesed. Now here's a little interesting thing, if you want to get a little cosmological here. Our universe, we look around, scientists says, comes from the Big Bang. And they asked for years and years, "Gee, what caused the Big Bang?" Now they think they kind of know, with this M-theory stuff and the superstring theory stuff. They think that there was a parallel universe. And that our universe was kind of like hanging around empty. And that these universes were kind of like floating around like waves. And that one full universe next to ours bumped into our universe in a place and spewed into it matter. And that was the Big Bang. Well, let's describe it a little bit more accurately. Our universe was a passive, empty universe. It was there. Indeed, when you get into the Torah of the Arisal, it speaks about how God first created the universe as empty. In other words, the place is what we call the kelim, and only then the lights entered into it. Gee, kind of sounds like modern science read the Ari. Who knows? Getting back to this. The parallel universe we call Elohim, God from the Bible, spew the energy in. Think of it for what it is. A sexual penetration. Now, you all know what I'm getting at with that. You understand? That's why everything is sexual. Language of Kabbalah is always sexual. It's penetrated. It ejaculated into this universe. And this universe was created in the symbolic 7 days, the 7 levels, the 7 energies corresponding to these lower 7 spheres. The first of which is this expansive energy called Chesed, day 1. Got it? And it expanded until finally, like it says in the Bible, God separated between the light and the darkness. There was the balancing act. And I must add that what was created out of these 7 days was not just this physical universe. It's also what we call the parallel energy universe, which I believe modern science is tapping into now, which they recognize as being dark matter and dark energy. Not that it's dark meaning bad, evil, or wrong, but dark meaning unknown to us. That is the parallel dimension, which we can call Yetzirah, the heavens, and as such, it is part of the heavens and the earth that is existing within these, in quotes, seven sephirot. So this expansive power is what initially gave rise to these things. We continue now to the fifth sephirah, which we call Gevurah. We call it the attribute of Din. Din means judgment. Don't get human here. Severity, din, judgment, actually should be defined as constriction, narrowing, refining, limiting. The exact opposite of the expansive movement is the contractive movement. Everything goes out, and then everything comes in. That is the way these things work. By the way, Ken here in text has mentioned one of my favorite television programs, which is, I believe, on the Science Channel called Through the Wormhole, hosted by Morgan Freeman. It's an excellent, excellent series of science programs. I highly encourage you getting the videos, watching them online or wherever you can. You'll learn a lot, especially if you take the time to contemplate it. This opposite energy to Hesed, this constrictive energy, everything goes out and everything comes in. I think even modern science speaks about how the universe is now expanding, and they're going to say it's going to expand to a point and then it's going to turn around and to be like crunch. Yep, that's Gevurah. Right now, according to the secrets of what we call the epochs, we're living in an epoch of Gevurah, what we call the Shemitah, the time when everything is very restrictive, because our consciousness right now, the definition of rational intellectual consciousness, that which we so praise as being intellect, is by nature very restrictive, limiting. It seeks to lock things in and rigidize things. The entire rational, analytic, academic, intellectual structure is by definition din, gevurah, and therefore the exact opposite everything that is required to expand out. So, somebody's asking, would gevurah be antimatter? I don't know. I'm not so sure that antimatter isn't the real matter and that our present matter is Gevurah. I think antimatter might be Hesed and our matter is Gevurah. Our whole concept and structure of thought, the way we build, the way we live, is to, again, structure, 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 limit, limit, focus, limit. Instead of being expansive out, we seek to shrink within. The entire nature of urbanization is exactly that. Instead of expanding it on the land, we contract and we squeeze unnaturally. How many times do you always hear me yell and scream against urbanization and urban living? And everybody has every excuse under the sun not to leave the big cities. If we ever want to talk about an apocalypse, the reason why the urban areas are doomed to destruction isn't because God's going to get him because he doesn't like the cities. Get all of that stuff. Urbanization by definition is unnatural. And that which is unnatural will eventually submit to natural flow. So that which you bring together will eventually expand apart. So Gevurah brings together, but Hesed is going to expand out. So the destruction of urbanization will actually be a positive Hesed experience. I'm going to get a little esoteric here and freak some of you out.
Those of you who are familiar with the tarot deck, one of the cards of the tarot deck is called the Castle. It's one of the major arcana. And if you see, it's the lightning that strikes the castle, toppling the people who are living in the castle, and they fall down to the ground. But the ground is nature, like the Garden of Eden, and like paradise. So the lightning bolt that hits is actually chesed, that takes them out of the structure of limitation of the Gevurah and brings them back to nature, even though it's a cataclysmic way of having to do it. It's still a very act of chesed. So that's why I said, we want to talk about building or destroying and apply it to chesed and Gevurah. So limitingly, right? Can't do it. You have to see the ebb and flow of nature, and you will see the chesed and Gevurah in all things. Very few of you who are with me live ever actually been out here to Tennessee and my home out here in the woods. But those of you who have been here, you know it's a pretty rural area. My point that I'm getting at is, we get a lot of wildlife out here. No, not big old bears or wild boars or anything, you know, coming down my driveway. But just the insect life, I note. And I sit out and I watch and I observe and I learn. And it is so profound just to see how nature acts. I can literally see how the frogs go and catch their flies. Or how my dog might go and run after a bee or a bird and try to jump up and get him out of the air. This is the natural way of things. Sometimes they get caught and sometimes they don't. It's the ebb and flow, movement of life. You and I are no different. Granted, if I'm walking out my door, I really do not anticipate that a big giant frog is going to come with his tail and, not his tail, but his tongue and suck me in. But isn't life like a big giant frog? Where in which a tongue can come and suck us in at any moment? Sometimes we are. Sometimes we're not. Sometimes things in life motivate and push us and move us. Some things in life stifle us and make us stay still. For those of you who know anything about martial arts, you know that there is a time to be absolutely still. And then burst out with immediate movement. There's a time to be silent. And there's a time to make noise. And we go from one to the other in a constant ebb and flow and movement of nature. This is why I was playing the music for you before we began our class, to get you to move. This is what it's all about. Natural movement. And as we proceed and we get into the lower, more conscious sphere, we will talk about what we call in psychology libido energy, which is actual life force movement, which is always expressed through sexuality and everything else. These are the things that move us. That's why sex is such a powerful force and why it must be properly expressed. So again, Gevurah. We call it the left arm. Again, David calls it the Gevurah. This is the sphere that applied to Yitzhak Avinu. Yitzhak was the man who was always the one who was always trying to hold things in. Rather than be expansive out, he was the one holding things in. It's very interesting how in our world today we have everything absolutely reversed. Think about modern politics, what we call conservative and liberal. If you were to think about it, we call the liberal the left. We call conservative the right. On the contrary, they should be reversed. Because it's the liberal that wants to expand out all kinds of new things and new ways and strange things. That's right. Where the conservative wants to stay structured where it is. That's left. symbolically speaking. We always refer to the left and the right by colors.
Communism embraced the color red, where in which today red here in the United States is referred to as the conservative color, whereas blue, which has always been patriotic American, is referred to as the liberal color. Interesting reversals, because the minds are not clear and therefore are inverting nature. Again, can't push Mama Nature too far before she pushes back. Remember Katrina. Moving right along. We call this, again, it says here that Yaakov made a reference to this attribute of Yitzhak when he referred to the fear of his father Isaac in Genesis 31:42. And this is what he calls the attribute of severe or strict justice, judgment. And he says there are also many different shades of red. He says, Yesh betola atashani, which is like crimson. Just like you have different levels of expansiveness in waves, so you have levels of restriction and contraction in waves and waves. So who can describe all of these different things? And he goes here that this, the arm against, like the left arm, right? We call that, you know, severe din. But it is also connected to Rachamim, which is the center column. Alright? And therefore, it is that which is closer to the center, is less din, etc. and so on. But now, continues, says here, and this then quotes the Pasuk from Song of Songs, chapter 5, verse 10. My beloved is white and ruddy, surrounded by myriads. Very interesting what he's trying to deal with here is that this concept of restriction itself is subject to an influence of movement which doesn't allow it to become overwhelmingly rigid without movement, but to balance between movement and stillness, silence and sound. And that's what we call Rahamim or Tiferet, the place in the center. So the further away you are from the center, the more rigid and structured things become. Whereas the closer to the center you get, the more ability of balance. I don't want to say more movement or more mercy, because I don't know how we could describe those things in actual terms. Balance. Everything in life is about balance. When we meditate, one of the meditative traditions is to dance in meditation. How do you dance? What do you do? Like, you know, the twist? Something like that? Remember good old Chubby Checker? No. All that Nachman stuff, as far as I'm concerned, is totally wrong. I'm not going to get into it. I have absolutely no attachment to the Breslov. I see no light in it at all, but that's just me. A lot of people don't like my views on that, but that's just too bad. I think they're a very dangerous cult. The Nanachs, I think, are a very dangerous cult, and they should be avoided, in my opinion, at all costs. But anyway, getting back to reality, which certainly, apparently, they are not in. With movement, a mention is made by Avraham, the son of Rambam, in his book, Hamaspik Lov de Hashem. He says that he's noticed that the Sufi in Islam have adopted a number of the traditions from our old prophetic meditative teachings. And that indeed is true. One of the ways of dancing, maybe you've heard the swirling dervishes, which is the old names for the Muslim Sufis. Well, this was an old prophetic way. You would play music and you would literally close your eyes and dance around in a circle, just twirl around in a circle. Eventually you'll get dizzy,
eventually you'll collapse. Music then stops. And when your mind is properly trained and focused, you can then go beyond into the spirit of prophecy. This is actually a very good way to stay focused. And mind you, to get out of your conscious mind, those who wish or ever try to use drugs, you will forever poison and destroy your path. Because they subvert the chemical brainwaves necessary and suppress those areas which need to be opened. So for those people who smoke pot and hashish and all that, it is advisable to keep them as far away from meditation as possible, because literally they can become psychotic. It is very, very dangerous. It's very strong imbalance and should be avoided at all costs. Everything has to be balanced in the center. Now we move on to Tiferet, that center. We call it Rachamim. Again, David HaMelech from our Pasuk in Chronicles calls it Tiferet. We say that this is the likeness of Yaakov Avinu. Why? Because Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, is the archetypal primordial man. He is God's man on earth. Take a look at the historical life of Jacob. Does this guy really look like God's man on earth? What does the word Jacob mean? He's a cheater. He has fights with his brother. He has fights with his father-in-law. He gets into problems with his wives. He has problems with his daughter. He's got problems with his neighbors. He's got problems with his kids. This is a man who is Mr. Problems. And yet he is considered God's man. Because Jacob and Israel, regardless of the historicity of the individual, are psychological archetypes of the undeveloped and developed full human being. When you get into the theoretical Kabbalah of the Ari, and he speaks of the small face, Zer Anpin. Zer Anpin has two faces. One's called Jacob, one's called Israel. Lower face called Jacob, the higher face called Israel. Each one of us, in our psychological development as a human being, ladies, this includes you too, because remember, all people, male and female, are all part of greater man, so you are as much a part of Jacob as anyone. So when you speak of the matriarchs, and we speak of the Sephiroth faces called Rachel and Leah, these are all psychological attributes as well. So every one of us, male and female, have the psychological faces called Israel, or Jacob, or Rachel, and Leah. Male or female, doesn't matter. We're all human beings in that respect. And in all due respect, biological plumbing don't make no difference. And granted, though we are psychically, psychologically, mentally different too, doesn't make a difference. We are all part of the collective consciousness. Male and female are the two yin-yang of the collective consciousness. And a point that Carl Jung makes. Every physical male is only 51% male. He has 49% female inside him called his unconscious, right? And every woman, female, 51% female, 49% male inside. Every male, every female has inside them the equal and opposite. This is what he called the anima and the animus. And they play very pivotal psychological roles in each and every one of us. This is what, in the theoretical Kabbalah, they call the Sephirotic faces of, again, from the male side, Jacob Israel, the female side, Rachel Leah. So therefore, don't get sexist here. Every male here has Rachel and Leah within him. Every female here has Yaakov and Israel in her, because it's in us. That is how you must understand. Jacob, therefore, is the image wherein which everything balances. It is a metaphor of the balanced human being, male and female. And this is why, continue here, it's called the Especloria Mi'ira, the clear mirror. Because when we as an individual are balanced psychologically, and psychologically means consciously and unconsciously, our lifestyle is proper, our mind, our feelings, notice I didn't say emotions, balanced, we're in harmony with nature. That makes us Jacob. And when we can rise above the natural order into what we can call the supernatural order, when the mind below can influence and even dominate into the collective realm, that's when we symbolically say Yaakov becomes Israel. Referencing, of course, the famous biblical story of Jacob wrestling with the angel and defeating him. Came at a cost. Everything comes at a cost. That's life. That's nature. It's just the way it is. We each seek, as Jacob, to become Israel. Israel, therefore, is a psychological archetype. And it is completely over and above any kind of ethnical or national or religious identity. We also call this the power of the sun, meaning the internal power. And it's also, and our sages called it the tree of life and the world to come, because again, when we die and leave this physical coil, we go into that parallel universe, which is next to this one. That's why we keep bouncing back and forth, reincarnation and the like. That's the tree of life. The original place of the Garden of Eden was in a domain which today we say is made up of dark matter and dark energy. And then we came down into this area here, which is this area which we know today. So the power of the sun, S-U-N, the power of the sun of the sky, symbolic of daylight, okay? That's always the metaphor of the active form. The Tiferet is always referred to as the sun, and of course Malchut, which we'll discuss later, the moon. And that again is the balance and the power of heaven and earth, physical and what we call spiritual, male and female, and on with all the symbolisms. We also say that it's represented by the letter Zion, which has its own secrets to it. But it's also referenced here to the verse in Exodus 20, verse 21, where God speaks about creating an altar to him. And he goes, wherever I allow my name to be mentioned, I will come in there and bless you. That's the place. What does it mean that wherever place God's name is called? This is that elevation of consciousness from lower man to higher man. Lower in this one limited intellectual structured world of Gevura, back into the center, where in which we can go into the expansive way. You don't leave the physical. That's why we're not in the Hesed. We go off in the Hesed, then we're up out of the body, we're all floating around the universe, no. But we're not limited to the body, Gevura. We're not out of the body, Hesed. We're in that middle place. And that middle place symbolically referred to as Jacob. Until such a time we can rise to become Israel. That's called the attribute of the day, the rising of the sun. Why? Because the entire power of sunlight, energy, and life emanates from the source of this energetic flow. And he goes, this is the internal source of sunlight. And again, he concludes with the words, the Hamevin Yavin. So again, I'm trying to place emphasis here. I'm trying to understand this not so much intellectually, but experientially. The ebb and flow of human consciousness. When we meditate, this is what we experience. Somebody's asking me here, why am I not translating the names of the Sefirot? Are their translations misleading? No, I just never thought of it. Hesed means mercy. Gavura means severity, Tiferet means heart. But what does that mean? They're basing it upon the words of this verse in Chronicles. But the word in itself is just like you will, the hook that you hang your hat on. and it's not really teaching you much about the entire house and who lives in it. So they'll, you know, after teaching this stuff, I guess, what, for 30 years now, I kind of figure people might know what the words mean. You're right. I shouldn't have made that conclusion. But, sorry. It's just the way these things are. Now, again, he concludes here with this understanding, Hamevin Yavin. Now, Sean here in text makes a very interesting point. He says how the sun is itself a balance of expansive fusion, energy, and constrictive gravity. That's true. And the sun, therefore, balances the polarity. The sun, therefore, is this Tiferet. It is Jacob. It is our example and image. So when we talk about receiving enlightenment, what do we call it? Light, right? I see light, etc. and so on. This is all the symbolic natures of how the mind experiences these things through the vessels of our thoughts. And he concludes, and he says that these three attributes, which are attributed to the fathers, this is why our sages said that the fathers themselves are the Merkava. Now, we always talk about the Merkava. The Merkava is essential to all meditative practice. The purpose of the Merkava chariot is to recognize that we are the chariot of God. God works through us. When we talk about Ma'ase Merkava, we're talking about aligning our own polarities in such a way that the divine universal mind can find a complete open vessel through us, to act through us and move through us, travel, if you will, through us. We become the Merkava. This is the work of the Merkava. And that is why the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were called the Merkava. Because these three individuals of old brought into humanity through their individual archetypal psychologies a sense of structure and balance, the likes of which all humanity has since been seeking. So we say that the souls of the fathers emanated from these attributes, and indeed they did. All right? They are the same as these attributes. And they themselves are the Merkava to Bina, Bina being, of course, the realm of mind. So indeed, mind at the collective level, at the unconscious level, operates through movement which is motivated by passion. It expands out, constricts within, and finds the appropriate balance between the two. But all of these forces are in a constant state of movement. There is always that which is going out. There is always that which is restricting in. There is always that which is seeking balance. All of these things are happening, what we call, under the surface, in our minds, in the unconscious, but also in that concealed domain of the universe. Call it dark matter, dark energy, or whatever. There is always this constant movement. When we expand our minds, call it meditation, this is what we come into contact with. And we seek to tame these forces in the universe. First, they have to be tamed within ourselves. So if you look within your own self as you meditate, you'll find that sometimes you feel motivated to just jump out and do. Sometimes you feel just motivated to sit back and not do. And you got to find that right balance, what is and isn't. Where is and where is not. And when you find that right balance, you will come into the center. So, this is always, here, somebody in text is saying that the entrance to Tiferet, it's a rough task, a lot of digging within, questioning self-ego. And you say, just your own experience? No, it's not just your own experience. It's the collective human experience. Every human being has gone through this struggle. Since the day collective humanity at our level Remember, not all of humanity fell out of Eden. Only part of us did. Those of us who are here, our job is to maintain and achieve this balance. And when we do, only then will great things happen. But okay, that concludes the section for tonight. God be willing, we will pick up in our next class next week. Don't forget, our Book of Judges series is tomorrow night, Tuesday, and Wednesday night, our Mystical Legends of the Talmud and our How to Live a Godly Life class. God be willing, we will see you all then. All right? God bless. Have a great week. Shalom.